On Sunday, December 27th at 11 p.m., Sugar My Bowl presents composer, guitarist, and another featured artist at the Winter Jazz Festival in January, Julian Lage. Join us as we discuss Julian's career and all things guitar from a self-described guitar nerd. That's Sunday, December 27th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving. So bad. I feel so funny. I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on. Save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. And our guest for this evening will be featured at the Winter Jazz Festival in January, composer, guitarist Julian Lage. And after our theme by Miss Nina Simone, we'll hear a selection from Julian's most recent release, World Fair, his solo guitar production. Julian Lage will be performing a solo guitar set at the Winter Jazz Festival to open the evening of January 17th, which will then be followed by a tribute to John Coltrane, group Rova, and they'll be performing John Coltrane's Ascension, their version. So we're going to start off the program with Missouri from Julian Lage's World's Fair. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
In my bowl. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Julian Lage.
Julian Lage, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Oh, my pleasure.
And joining WBAI again, as you the guitarist who accompanied Tana Alexa during International Working Women's Day. I think it was 2009.
Yeah, it was some years ago, and it was really fun.
Yeah, I'm glad you were available for that. And as you can see, we had no problem with male artists accompanying the women's artists during International Working Women's Day.
Not at all.
And it was really a great opportunity to hear you cut loose.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That was really fun. I love her music, and she's so talented and such a good person. And honestly, that was the only time I've ever gotten to play with her. And I'm so glad it was for you and on the radio, because that was very special for me.
And I'd like to thank Tana Alexa as well for helping to make this happen.
Good, I'm glad.
I also have to say, a star shone on December 25th in the sky of Marin County, California.
I'm a Christmas baby. I was born on Christmas Day, and I love it. I've met so many people who are born on Christmas, and there's often mixed reviews. Some people think it's the worst, some people think it's the best. I'm kind of in the latter category, because more times than not, everybody's together, you know, you're with family, and it's a good way to spend it.
So technically, you've been playing since you were 5 years old?
Yeah, I started playing guitar when I was 5 years old, because my father, he had started playing only about a year before then. When I was 4, he got a guitar, and he loved it so much that I basically wanted something to do with my dad. I'm the youngest of 5 children. You know, I have 3 sisters and a brother. And,
oh, wow.
And they all do wonderful things, and they're really gifted. And just totally, even as we were kids, they were always absorbed in whatever their interest was, whether it was literature or design or mathematics, whatever. So guitar for me was kind of my thing, you know, something I could do with my dad, or so I envisioned as a kid. And so I begged my parents for a guitar. And they said if I was still interested when I was 5, they would get me one. So sure enough, I was, and they did. And I began taking lessons with my father, and even as I started studying with other teachers. And to this day, my father's always remained kind of a musical coach of sorts. You know, he knows so much about the guitar, even though he doesn't play it all that much. He's such a great observer. And that dynamic was such a huge part of me being into it. It really helped kind of feed the fire from a young age.
You just kept going with it. You weren't tempted to go in another direction? You were hooked?
I was hooked, yeah. And I had other things I was interested in as a young person as well, but playing guitar, it kind of carried a component of relationship that really stood out. In other words, it wasn't only taking guitar lessons to get better at the guitar, but my teachers were people I really grew close to as mentors and friends. And so the community was just so instantly palpable to me. I thought, wow, regardless of the playing, I like these people. I like how they treat each other. And so that was always very important to me. And I think it definitely still is. Maybe that's a factor that set it apart from other activities.
When you were playing at 5, I understood you were actually interested at 4 and were told to wait a year. And then I heard that the same was true with your being invited to play with Carlos Santana. He had invited you at 7, and you were told, okay, well, maybe after a year, we'll see. Was that a general strategy in your, development?
In my upbringing?
Yeah.
I don't know if I could generalize with regard to Santana. That was, like so many things, was kind of a consensus, you know. It wasn't my parents saying that we had to wait a year. I personally, too, it was a bit overwhelming, you know. So I think they, much as anything, they kind of read my response to it and said, well, let's give it not the healthiest thing psychologically to go from driving up as a 7-year-old boy and saying, gosh, we'll go see this concert, and then the next moment say, well, you're going to go perform in front of 20,000 people for the first time. That can be traumatic if not dealt with in a kind of a careful way. So, and I think I was aware of that, and they were aware of it. So take something more general. It wouldn't be the wait a year approach necessarily, as much as just kind of look at things from all sides. You know, that would be the general thing. Some things were a no-brainer. Oh, of course, go play. It seems you're totally ready for this. And other things might have appeal on one level, like, oh, this would be great for your music. And on another level, sometimes it could have been detrimental emotionally if you weren't kind of prepared for it. So that was always a line that was being straddled. Frankly, I feel like those same concerns come into play for me today. because it really is the whole picture that you have to consider to the best that you can.
that way. You can. I think that's how he meant the piece to be played, don't you? Scott would love that.
The reason why I like the city is there's so much to it. I mean, I live in Santa Rosa, and it's not that big to me. I mean, I know lots of places there. But, like, after I go to the conservatory, I have my day planned out where I want to go next in the city. Like, sometimes we'll just go to Haight just to look at what there is, like Haight Ashbury Music. That's a really nice place. All different music stores, that's like the main place we'll go. I like that because there's lots about music there. Yeah, so it's a nice place.
So I actually need to ask you to tell people about Jewels at Eight.
Sure. Jewels at Eight is a documentary that was made over the course of the time that I was actually 7 years old and just a little bit into being eight. That was made by a director getting his PhD master's, in film at Stanford University. The project represented his thesis, and he had a vision to follow a young musician or someone who was active in some of the arts, but I think specifically musically involved, follow them through their life as a kid with their family, going to school, you know, et cetera, as well as following kind of their professional trajectory. You know, it's a format that's been done many times. There's a lot of documentaries like that in different fields. But he approached my family and I because he had asked around the Bay Area to older musicians and said, are there any young people you think would make for good subjects? And my name came up. And kind of similarly to those other scenarios, I think we as a family talked about it and just thought, you know, why? You know, why would you? It was, you have to keep in mind at the time, I wasn't recording. I was performing a little bit, but I was anonymous. And so it wasn't like there was an angle of promotion. Oh, this could help promote your record. That's but none of that existed. So it was such a blip that it almost seemed like, well, to what end would this be beneficial? So we said no. And similarly, the director said, well, we not only said no, we said, here's some other people you could consider. You know, Taylor Eichsee. Who I grew up with, so he could be great. There was another musician named Sasha Smith, I think we recommended, maybe Sean Erickson. These were all young musicians in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, I'll take a look. And he searched around and came back, I don't know, a few months later and said, you know what, I checked, but I really think Julian made it. So we talked about it, and it came to fruition that this seemed to be more of a documentary about him than it would be about me, which was great. No, which was better because his artistic vision was very clear and it was very aesthetically pleasing. You know, it was a 20-minute black and white documentary. The narrative he was looking for had more to do with just kind of interviewing my parents, myself, teachers of mine, but I actually don't even play that much in the movie. There's no real shots of me. You don't really know how I play. If you add it up all the moments, there's probably 15 seconds total. So, you know, my parents being aesthetically and artistically hip, I think they saw me and said, oh, well, that's kind of cool, you know, that seems cool. I said, well, I feel comfortable with that. So we did it. The life it had after it was made was one of its own. It did very well for the director. He went on to, that particular film was nominated for Academy Award for documentaries, which was wonderful for his career. And it was on PBS a few times a year, many years. They played it around Christmas. And it was exactly what we had hoped. It was kind of this mysterious thing that didn't really push things one way or the other. And it was perfect.
If yeah. people are interested, the director's name is Mark Becker, and the mm-hmm. film is Jewels at 8, and it is actually available. You could actually mm-hmm. have a copy if you go to Mark Becker's site. So
yeah, I should do that. I don't yes. have any copies of it. I should do it. I'd love to see it again.
Just to tell you, I had no idea all of this was going on when I saw you with Tana at WBA. I had no idea all of this other stuff happened before you appeared.
That's
because
great.
I
That's
yeah,
great.
I thought
How
so
would you?
Too.
Yeah,
yeah. But I mean, I knew yeah. that you were playing in, you know, you were playing jazz. So
right.
you know, it was interesting to find out all of this backstory.
fabulous! Yeah, it was great. Thank you.
Now, I notice your projects, as a leader, they tend to be duets with, you know, like Nels Klein, Chris Eldridge, yeah. Fred Hirsch. Right. And you have a trio with Scott Coley and Ken Wollinson. And
yeah, Kenny Wollinson.
Yeah. And you tend to record and work with small ensembles. Is this a setting that you prefer?
I think so. I have less experience with larger ensembles, though, so I can't say that I wouldn't love them. But definitely smaller ensembles are, they feel, in a lot of ways, they feel appropriate given the instrument, the guitar, and also my interests about how the guitar integrates with a band. You know, with small ensembles, guitar has a lot of leverage to be out front, in the background, in the middle. It can kind of be a shapeshifter of sorts. And often, and it's not impossible at all, but in a larger ensemble, the role of the guitar, as well as all the other instruments, typically is a little more prescribed, you know, and that aids in it being effective. You think of the Pat Metheny group or Maria Schneider's orchestras, where everyone, kind of like a good team, everyone knows what their job is and they do exceptionally well. And the sum is greater than the parts kind of thing. So
right.
I personally don't, I don't have that much experience with that. So with smaller ensembles, you kind of get to show up and play what you want. And it often, just by design, will contextualize the music and give you a sense of orchestration. So I like the agility of a smaller ensemble. And furthermore, all the bands I'm in are with people I really, really love as people, you know, as friends. So like anything, if there's someone you like spending time with, you might as well just spend time with them and not everybody else at the same time.
Right.
So it's something I cherish very much, whether it be with Fred or Chris or Nels or my band. I kind of feel like I have the best seat in the house, you know?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I noticed you played with Dave Grisman. You recorded with him when you were 9, I think. And
around that time.
Yeah, and you, of course, Gary Burton discovered your playing, and you started playing with him when you were 12. Mm-hmm. What was it like as a young artist working and playing with these two?
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. Similar in a lot of ways. I mean, both of them, kind of without me realizing it from the 30,000 feet overhead view, are musicians who really created their own genres very early on. You know, as young people, they were leaders of the band. They were coming from a tradition, but with open arms welcoming the music of the day, you know. And I didn't see that as abnormal because it's kind of all I knew. But in retrospect, I realized I was around these really progressive people, and attributes they both shared in common were that they were, for as excellent as they were not ever stingy or protective of their legacy. You know, they weren't, there was none of this, there's no hazing, there's no, you know, you got to keep up, kid. They're both so secure in what they do and have been for so long that with me, they basically invited me in and also lifted me up tremendously. I remember being struck with that. When I played with both of them, I sounded better than I ever sounded. You know, I thought, well, what's that about? How are they doing that? And you start to learn that it's in their best interest to lift every, it's not only in their best interest, it's what just they do it without thinking about it, but they make the people around them play better and commit more and go for things and take risks. And it's unreal to be around people like that, but it's also very comfortable. It's the best I ever felt was playing with those people as a young person. And in retrospect, it's always funny because you can look at it and say, well, were you nervous or why wasn't I more freaked out? Well, I think that's one of the things that make these people the greatest, is that they actually make you better and they diffuse everything that you were worried about. And then suddenly the job is really simple. You just play music. It's like playing with someone your own age, with who's not afraid of anything. So I'm so lucky, you know. And they also, they kind of planted two seeds, which later grew into, I think, very distinct branches within my musical life, which one would be David Grisman kind of planted the seed of acoustic music and string music, which incorporates bluegrass and old time and a lot of the music I play with Chris Eldridge, as well as with my solo guitar project. And then with Gary, that was obviously the seed of jazz, you know, and the rich lineage that exists there. So I'm grateful that those weren't ever pointed out as being incompatible when I was a kid, because I figured they're both of the same soil, and I think they really are. Thank you.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of the program of which you are listening. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is Julian Lage, guitarist extraordinaire. Yeah, there are plenty of them, and he's one of them. What we're listening to right now is our former Sugar guest, Gary Burton, who features Julian Lage on his Next Generation recording. This is a 2005 Concord Music release, and this is Julian Lage's composition, Clarity. We have Gary Burton on vibraphone, Julian Lage on guitar, Vadim Neselowski on piano, and James Williams on drums, and Lakeith Curtis on bass. Before that, we heard Old Souls from David Grisman from his release Dog Duos. This is a 1999 acoustic disc recording. Dave Grisman on mandolin and mandola, and Julian Lage on guitar. Before that, we heard Stone Cross from Julian Lage and Chris Eldridge. I think I said Etheridge before. Chris Eldridge from Avalon. That's a 2014 Modern Lore release. Julian Lage on guitar and Chris Eldridge on guitar, voice on others. Before that, we heard Racy from Nels Klein and Julian Lage from Room. That's a 2014 Mack Avenue Records release. Julian Lage on acoustic electric guitar on the left channel, and Nels Klein on acoustic electric guitar on the right channel. Before that, we heard Tour 1 from Julian Lage, his debut release as a leader, Sounding Point. That's a 2009 MRC Records release. That's Julian Lage on guitar, along with Taylor Agesti on piano. Before that, we heard The Informant, also from Sounding Board. That's Julian Lage on guitar and Bella Fleck on banjo. Before that, we heard a film excerpt from Jules at Eight, the Mark Becker-directed short from Meteor Films that was released in 1996. And before that, we heard Stealthiness, Fred Hirsch and Julian Lage from Free Flying. That's a 2013 Palmetto Records release. It's Fred Hirsch on piano and Julian Lage on guitar. Before that, as mentioned, Missouri from Julian Lage's solo guitar effort World's Fair, which was released earlier this year, January this year, on Modern Lore Records. Oh, and of course, we opened our program with our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from Nina Simone, the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This is an RCA BMG compilation that was originally recorded in 1967, and the compilation was released in 1998. Stay tuned for On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams, who will let you know about the future upcoming dates for Julian Lage and other former Sugar guests right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. And by the way, happy belated Birth Earth Day to Julian Lage. He's a Christmas baby. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for December 27th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar in My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's guest is guitarist Julian Lage. You can see him on December 31st at The Stone, and in January at Cornelia Street Cafe on the 13th, and at the Winter Jazz Fest's closing event on the 17th. And we have lots more music for you this week. We start with pianist and vocalist Diane Shore, who's at Iridium for Frank Sinatra's centennial celebration until the 28th. Guitarist Mark Rebo is at The Stone with John Zorn on December 29th. Pianist Harold Mayburn is at Smoke in a John Coltrane festival until the 31st. And trombonist Craig Harris is at Sister's Place on New Year's Eve. Saxophonist Lou Donaldson leads a quartet at the Jazz Standard from January 1st through 3rd, 2016. Bassist William Parker is at the Stone with Paul Nielsen on January 9th. Looking ahead a little bit, Arts for Art, producers of the annual Vision Fest, are sponsoring a nearly month-long Justice's Compassion Festival at Clemente Soto Vélez Center from January 4th through 24th with dancer Patricia Nicholson Parker, bassist William Parker, and many more. Finally, looking a little further ahead, the Winter Jazz Fest blows back into town at various venues around Greenwich Village from the 13th to 17th with two marathon nights of music on the 15th to the 16th. Look for fuller coverage in our next installment and a preview and full cheat sheet on our blog online. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to suginmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Suga is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter or Facebook, look for us there also. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website to find out more. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our biweekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, January 10th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on The Bandstand.
Hello, this is Hugh Masekela in New York. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. Don't lose your mind. Don't move that dial. Don't groove to anything else.
understood he also, Gary Burton, assisted you in learning how to conduct as a business person as well. Conduct yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Well, just being around and watching how he managed the affairs of being a touring musician. I mean, it was in plain sight to see, oh, wow, that's how you create a set list. That's how you pay a band. That's how you take care of taxes. That's how you book a gig. That's how you book your travel. And I just watched him and would ask him a lot of pestering questions and just kind of keep notes about how it's done. And Gary also has such a disposition for that, where I think he's very familiar with being in the position of role model when it comes to those things. So everything he does is done with such a grace and such a clarity that you could not ask a single question and just watch him go take a project from A to Z, and you'd be given a complete lesson in how to do it. There's nothing murky. It's only clarity and only intelligence. And so I feel so lucky to have grown up around him. I mean, I can't even begin to say how blessed I feel.
I noticed that in your band, the group that you recorded with on Gladwell.
Oh, yeah.
That you have a similar type of generosity when playing with the group. Is that a conscious thing, or just you grew into that type of leader?
Well, that's a great question. In that particular band, which was existed for about 5 years, the orchestration was guitar, saxophone, cello, bass, and percussion. And on an arranging level, the guitar in a lot of ways was not the best, in my opinion, not the best suited to being the leader of that band. And not in a modest kind of way, but just frequency wise. Saxophone was louder and covered a larger range. I always wanted to hear the saxophone play noise. Cello similarly could kind of cut through, but the cello also had this allegiance to the bass and the low frequencies. And the saxophone went really high. So in a lot of ways, the guitar was the perfect instrument in the middle of that band. I would have been the best suited rhythm guitar player for my band. because then everything would, and it's similar to a string quartet or small orchestra, everything would kind of have its place and it could move freely. We didn't do that, however, and that was part of the danger and the fun of it, was that the cello at one moment could be a supportive instrument with the bass and then a second later be way on the front line, going really high up into this range. And similar to saxophone, which was just kind of playing harmony parts in the middle, would be an altissimo range. And very similarly, the guitar would be doing these rhythmic patterns with the drums, and then all of a sudden I would be the lead soloist. So I think it can read as generosity in a certain way, but it was also the only way that band could function. It was everyone kind of warranted being all over the place all the time, so we had to be very intelligent about who played when and where all the time. So it was an interesting challenge. It was very hard because it was so dependent on writing, you know. That band, at its best, really had so much to do with just the camaraderie that existed in the band and everybody putting in and adding and contributing. So in retrospect, I view that as a total collective effort, even though it had my name on it.
World's Fair.
Yeah, that's
World's Fair. Your solo guitar effort. How did you get to the point where you, okay, I'm ready to do this. I can do this now, this solo guitar thing.
Well, that's a great question. Solo guitar for me was always daunting, you know, and it's one of the things where I don't even think I entertained the thought of doing it ever, because it's also such a personal endeavor that it's hard to look at one solo guitarist and say, I want to play solo guitar. I mean, it's not hard if you're attracted instantly to somebody, but I always felt like solo guitar was a window into such a personal side of people that there were some things I would relate to, and I'd say, oh, that's cool. And other times I'd think, I like that part of the solo guitar, but maybe I crave this thing over here. You know, I wasn't looking with enough attention at solo guitar over the years, other than the fact that some songs would stand out on records. And obviously I just had this reverence for people like Lenny Bro or Martin Taylor or Joe Pass or, you know, Martin Simpson or, you know, any of these great solo guitar players.
Jim Hall.
Jim didn't really do a whole lot of solo guitar. Mm-hmm. There's one recording he would consider a solo guitar record, but they're overdubs.
Okay.
And, you know, so Jim was, that was in a way, because I was always such a Jim-ophile, I always thought, well, he was always in duos or trios and sometimes quartets, you know. So that was academically speaking, that was the type of guitar player I've always trained to be.
I see.
So the solo thing was more understood as just like, wow, that must be hard. I didn't even see myself in the shoes. Then about 3 years ago, I was given a grant to make the record by the Shifting Foundation. Yeah. And the Shifting Foundation is comprised of David Breskin and Chelsea Hadley. And these are just two of the most kind of forward-thinking people. And they happen to have this foundation that really sponsors all artists, poets, dancers, musicians, filmmakers, artists, you know. And so we met up through Nels Klein, and they said, you know, we've got this grant. We award grants to people in creative fields. What's a project that you would want to do? And at the time, I actually told them about a completely different project. It was an educational model I had been working on for years that involved kind of a peer music teaching. And think of it like healthy peer pressure, where, you know, someone say, hey, I'm going to write a song today. Why don't you write a song and we'll compare notes. And I used to run this thing called Music Right Now. And I told them I had this whole proposal, and they said, that's cool, but we worry we'll lose you to the computer screen, and you'll just be working on a website. What are you afraid of? Which is what the question became of. And I said, well, the scariest thing I could imagine, musically speaking, would be to play with one acoustic guitar, no overdubs, and be able to put on a program of an hour or so, you know. And they said, bingo, we will help you make that.
Wow.
I said, oh, okay, cool. So I started writing, and it was incredible, because I had to face all these ambiguous things I had kind of conjured up about the solo guitar. And even once I started recording it, I scrapped a lot of the music and redid it and rewrote it, because the basic principle that I was afraid of was that you're alone and you don't have enough. You know, it's an issue of scarcity somehow. And so I found myself overplaying and overwriting, and in the version that came out, what we were going for in those was actually taking advantage of the fact that you didn't have to fill up the space. You didn't have to imply things that weren't there. In other words, this was going to be music that any guitar player who just sits in their bedroom and plays all day would be very familiar with. And what occurred to me is that doesn't usually see the light of day. You know, things get hyped often, or things get added, you know, onto. But anyway, so in a nutshell, that became the framework for the project. And I love it so much. And in doing so, like everything, you start to realize, you look at the masters, and you go, oh, that's the problem they were solving when they did that. Or that Joe Pass was doing this to reconcile this issue that we all have. So it left me with just an even greater respect for the lineage of great guitarists.
I got to say, from World's Fair, I had heard and had read that there was no overdubbing. So I'm listening to I'm listening to Gardens, and I'm like, huh? I really like that one, by the way. But I'm listening to that one.
Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. I'm listening and wondering, one person is doing this? It was amazing. Amazing.
It's wild, right?
Yeah, oh, my gosh.
That's the guitar, though. The history of the guitar is amazing because there was a period very early on where the guitar, like when I say early on, I'm saying from when the banjo was popular and then the guitar became the new, you know, hot instrument, where guitars played so much stuff. And you even listen to guitar players on early Charlie Parker recordings or early Eddie Lang stuff. And these players were playing polyphonic stuff. They were playing chords. They were playing melodies. There was kind of no reason not to play the whole guitar, which is a pretty big, I mean, guitar has, what, 100, well over 100 notes on it, right? So there's a lot. It's like,
wow.
It surpasses the 88 keys of the piano. The only thing is you can't play them at the same time, the same way. But what you see is as saxophone players and trumpet players became the voice of jazz, guitar players started playing it very cool, you know, and there's 60, 80 years of a style of guitar playing in which you played more like a horn player. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. It's beautiful. But mechanistically, you're often just using about a small percentage of what the guitar actually does as an instrument. Mm-hmm. And so it's fun when you look back and you realize, God, it really goes with the times, you know? And I love that the guitar is capable of so much, and you can just kind of, you can piecemeal it out and show that side of it bit by bit, and hopefully it's tasteful.
Oh, my goodness, very much so. And for those who want to see it live, during the Winter Jazz Festival in January, on the 17th, Julian Lage is going to open. They're having a program, a Channeling Coltrane is the evening, Rova's Electric Ascension. They're going to do a tribute to John Coltrane's Ascension, or their interpretation of it. And that evening will be opened with Julian Lage and his solo guitar performance. Yay.
Yeah, I cannot wait. And those are some of my favorite musicians, too, in that. That particular evening, too. I mean, I would be there as a fan, let alone being there to play. So I look forward to that.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I take it you will be playing selections from World's Fair?
Absolutely. I'll be playing a program of music from the record.
Okay. Oh, it's wonderful. Well, we look forward to that. And thank you so much, Julian Lage, for joining Sugar in My Bowl this time.
My goodness, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. And after all these years, it's great to connect again. And hopefully I'll see you soon.
And you will see me in January for certain.
I'd like to thank
Gary Burton. Putting your name into my head again. He was our sugar guest last month. So,
great.
Yeah, it was really great talking to him about
He's
you.
The best.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. Gary is just the absolute best.
Did you teach at Berkeley as well?
Yeah, I've been teaching at Berkeley over the years. There was about a year and a half I was running a kind of a prototype music collective program there, and then I currently am teaching there through Kenny Warner's Effortless Mastery Institute, which is connected to his book, and I'm more or less a visiting resident. Sounds like a contradiction, but I go up there for a little bit, a few times a semester. So, I've had an ongoing relationship with them in the school, and I think very highly of them.
Would you consider being an ongoing, steady instructor sort of thing as opposed to visiting?
It would depend. You know, there's no shortage of people who teach at Berkeley and are doing, you know, at last I had heard there's roughly 4,000 students and about 1,100 guitar of those people are guitar players.
Oh.
And then, and within there, there's about 50, and I want to say 53 guitar teachers.
Okay.
So it is such a, they've got their thing down to a well-oiled machine. So
okay. If
my involvement would need to be there as something different or something they don't already have in spades. So, but also I love living in New York and I love being able to come in and out. So I'm happy right now and we'll see where it goes.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, Julian Lodge, for joining Sugar My Bowl. I really appreciate the time that you've provided for us.
Of course. Hey, thank you for your insight and questions. And yeah, hopefully I'll see you around.
I will definitely see you in January.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. I'll see you there.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of the program of which you've been listening. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening was Julian Lage, composer and guitarist. We are listening to right now Margaret, which was inspired by one of Julian Lage's singer-songwriter friends, Margaret Glaspie. This is the Julian Lage group. Gladwell is the name of the release. It's a 2011 MRC release. It's Julian Lage on guitar, Jorge Roder on acoustic bass, Orestes Rivas on cello, Tupac Mantilla on drums, and Dan Blake on tenor, saxophone, and melodica on other selections. Before that, we heard several selections from Julian Lage's solo guitar effort, which, as mentioned, will be performed at the Winter Jazz Festival on the 17th as an opening for Rova's John Coltrane Ascension performance. What we heard was Ryland, before that Peru, before that Century, before that Red Prairie Dawn, before that Gardens, which is my personal favorite, and Day and Age. And it was released in January of this year on Modern Lore Records. Before that, we heard a few more selections from Gladwell, the 2011 MRC release. We heard Telegram, and before that, we heard 233 Butler. Before that, we heard from our former Sugar guest, Gary Burton, his release Guided Tour from the new Gary Burton Quartet. We heard Sunday's Uncle. It's a 2013 Mac Avenue Records release. It has Gary Burton on vibraphone, Julian Lage, who is the composer of Sunday's Uncle, on guitar, and Antonio Sanchez on drums, Scott Coley on bass. And, of course, before that, we had On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams. As mentioned, the On the Bandstand list is available at Sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, .org. Just go to the blog, and you'll see the playlist, and you'll see the On the Bandstand listings. There will also be a rundown coming up, heading toward the Winter Jazz Festival, so you'll find a cheat sheet of all the Sugar guests who will be performing between January 13th and January 17th, 2016. Our final selection will be from World's Fair, Where or When, Julian Lage's January 2015 Modern Lore Records release. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next, and we'll see you on January 10th with our guest, James Blood Ulmer. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.